And welcome back to the Atlas Podcast. We've been gone for a while, but we're back again. My name's Alex. I'm joined by my co-host, Martin. Hello again, Martin.
As ever. Yeah. We haven't, even though it's been a while, Alex, I mean, where have you been? What have you been doing? I mean...
Oh, this and that. Looking up interesting things for the podcast, of course.
Dear, so good to be back. I don't know what we did with ourselves. Probably busy working or something.
Something like that, yeah. So we're back with a slightly amended, not format, but schedule. We're going to be coming out every couple of weeks rather than every week. We've been busy recording interviews with interesting people. And as a bit of a synchronicity, this episode is looking at 5G stuff, which is where we started the podcast almost 2 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. So, this week we've got the topics of, first of all, we're going to have a quick look at Rolls-Royce breaking the all-electric speed record. Then, as I said, we're going to be moving on to 5G technology, where it was, where it is, how it came to be. And finally, we're going to have a chat with Richard Foggy, who is instrumental in the UK 5G innovation network.
Amongst other things. We were definitely a fascinating guy with a vast history of knowledge. And we Absolutely. Get a bit nerdy in places, but it's great stuff.
Well, that's what we're here for. So, yeah, without much further ado, this is not weekly news, but it was this year. Rolls-Royce broke the all-electric aircraft world records for speed, I guess it is. So this is an all-electric plane that broke two world speed records in November 2021. It's an incredible piece of kit. It looks Spitfire-ish to me. Maybe that was the design they were going for. And it managed to get a total speed of 292.8 kilometers an hour, around 180 miles per hour, which for an electric vehicle is incredible in any circumstance, I think.
Yeah, and that's it. That was the average speed, wasn't it? That was the average speed over the 15 kilometer, but it reached a maximum of 287.
387, yeah, almost 400 miles an hour.
We're both getting it wrong. things never change, never change.
Of course.
But I think there's some really great facts on here about the, 400 kilowatt electric powertrain, the equivalent to a 335 bhp supercar. The power density required is huge. You know, it's equivalent to 7,500 phones. And you've got to fit that all within that chassis. And that's the kind of interesting thing about the design, is that it definitely looks a bit nose heavy. And that's probably to do with the distribution of the batteries and the electric motors and things like this. But it still's got a certain swagger to it, isn't it? Mm. It's a bit like a sports car feel about it.
It's very sleek. Yeah.
Sleek. Yeah. Really nice. Really nice. So, and that's a part of the UK government's program to acceleration of electrification of flight. There's a few of these programs underway about net zero as well for flight. But this just is kind of a proof of concept plane. We got to kind of look at the practicalities of flight and what these types of electrification or hydrogen fuel cell technologies can be utilized, and what kind of size planes and the economic effectiveness of these types of applications. But there's nothing like breaking a speed record to create a level of competition and innovation, which is, I think, primarily the story here, isn't it?
Well, that's it. And it's these projects I think people can often look at and think perhaps it's a bit of a folly, but actually what it's about is demonstrating the underlying technology. And as you mentioned sort of in passing there, this is all about all things electric and, transport are about energy density, which has always been the issue with battery technology and anything that goes into creating electric vehicles, especially in flight, is how do you get that amount of power in the smallest amount of mass? Because obviously if something's too heavy, it's never going to fly.
Yeah, and that's why I don't think anytime soon we're going to see an electric jumbo jet or something like this, an Airbus or a Boeing plane. But there's going to be the right type of energy storage systems for the right type of propulsion, depending on the requirement. But it just proves it is capable of doing these types of things, even if it's for a short period of time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we've discussed previously on the podcast, even though we won't see, I'm sure you're right, a jumbo jet anytime soon electrically powered, but we do have just down the road from us, I guess, the proposed airport for the first all electric passenger flights in Exeter Airport. Yeah. So it's on the way, and technologies like this, whilst they're wonderful for these sort of flashy shows, they work their way down into everything else, and the proofs of concept that come from it become more practical and wide used.
Excellent. So yeah, we look forward to see how those technology can be used, and there's also some work on horizontal and vertical takeoff and landing electric planes as well. So
the old VTOLs.
VTOL. Yes, I should have just gone straight for the acronym rather than stumbling over the word. Yeah, so we might touch on that as well. And I think next week, Alex, given a bit of a preview, I've recently got rid of my car, my old car, my lovely Fiat Coupe Turbo, 20 valve turbo, which I used to love, but it was time for it to go. And now I've gone carless. So next week I'll give a little bit of a story around using co-car as a way of transporting myself around using their electric cars and hiring them by the hour. So we'll very touch nice. More on that next week.
Sustainability by the hour. That's how it That's needs it. To be done. Alrighty. Yeah, so the other main topic today is 5G. Obviously, it's a big part of what we do at Atlas, and we're involved in lots of innovation projects. So we thought, why not just have a look at the history of 5G, how it came to be, and why it's still, I mean, because it's not a brand new technology, but it's still becoming more and more relevant.
And the interesting thing here particularly is 5G and Wi-Fi. Because they've come from different places, really. And Foggy touches on this in the interview, really. And that's what made us think, okay, this is something to explore from a technology point of view. And we have to look back a little bit about the history. And obviously, telco as a telecom industry has been around a lot longer than Wi-Fi or wireless Ethernet. But actually, that's once we go from a wired system to a wireless system. There's not that much difference between the two, because then we start talking about 1G, 2G, and all of those type of things. So if we take a step back to the beginning of the telecom industry with Alexander Graham Bell, invented the first telephone back in 1876.
Yeah.
So a long time ago, but obviously that took a little bit of time before that became established as a technology, but it was definitely revolutionary at that point. And then we got to 1926, where the first transatlantic telephone call was ever made. And so, you know, quite a long time between those two dates, but a lot of technology has to be created
put into place, and infrastructure as well, because those phone calls, it's transatlantic, which means there's a cable running in one form or another from the telephone call here and the telephone call there.
Absolutely. And you can actually go and see it in Cornwall, one of the original communication centres. It's actually on a beach in Cornwall, and it's a bit of a museum now. But
of course,
it's fascinating to think that these cables do today stretch across the Atlantic and then terminate in this building on a beach in Cornwall. The ambition of it is no ending. And then we get to the kind of first mobile phones in 1973. I find that quite hard to believe, but
there you go. Yeah, it feels early, doesn't it? But they were there. Yeah, almost 100 years after the original telephone.
Yeah.
We started to cut the wire.
But I think the first time most people, I think, was in the 1990s, really, when the technology was at a point that it was mass-produced and available to everybody who wanted to carry a brick around with them.
Yeah.
And then really, the turn of the century was when the Internet of Things and smartphones and 3 and 4G networking and all of these things come along. And that's actually when the first convergence really was between Wi-Fi or wireless Ethernet and the telco industry happened. It actually converged in a smartphone.
Yeah,
so we have they were today,
very separate. Yeah, they were very separate things. I mean, even I remember for sure having my first mobile phone, which did what a mobile phone did, which was call people and send text messages. That was about as technical as it got. And then you had the internet where you did your internet things. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's that 3G world is where those things started to cross over and become unified.
So yeah, the convergent didn't happen in the network. It happened in the devices on the network. Mm. And that's the big difference, really, moving to 5G. And that's the point that we want to make. The technology from 4G is still a part of that historic lineage from the telephone, if you like. We changed things and along the way, and fiber's been introduced and all of these types of things. But it's still based on the backbone of 200 or 150 years of a traditional technology.
Yeah.
Where you could say Wi-Fi hasn't had such a long history. Especially Wi-Fi as a brand. That's the interesting thing there. It's not really a technology as such. The same as 5G is a kind of brand label. Wi-Fi as a brand wasn't until 1999, once again, turn of the century. Mm. But there were wireless Ethernet cards and all of that type of thing that were available that you could put in your laptops and things like that before that. So you can see where those two technologies actually advanced independently from each other, but converged within a smartphone and moving forward from there. However, the physical hardware that those platforms were built on were completely different.
Hmm.
So where we're at with 5G is really having tech, both the hardware, the software, and all of the technology built on the same kind of backbone, basically, or same chipsets, the same, I want to say PC-based technology, but it's very dedicated, it's very generic technology that 5G will run on, and not very specific in the same way as had previously.
Yeah.
And that means that the convergence within the network itself is far more possible than ever before. And once we got the technology possibilities of the technology converging, then we really got to look at what the commercial side of it, the business world, the users, all of those other elements of it that come into whether something gets adopted or not en masse. And so really there is quite a quantum leap between 4G and 5G. From the fact of the way that businesses can operate, the business models, the technological alignment, and which might not be obvious to the consumer on the end of the 5G node, because they'll still just see a Wi-Fi signal and a 5G signal, and they're thinking, okay, I've still got two separate networks. But the more we go down this journey, I believe there's more convergence, and that you could say is the holy grail of wireless communications is that these two things, the consumer world and the business world of these wireless technologies, converge into one.
Yes, so it's not just phones doing computer things and computers doing phone things, but actually all technology doing networked things. Having access to the same pool of resources, basically.
And there are four main areas that they're driving this convergence. One is the enterprise and campus network approach. Mm-hmm. So you can look at, obviously, some of the internet was born out of that world of educational establishments want to communicate with each other one way, shape or form. Then you've got the industrial networks. So the space that we predominantly live in our day-to-day lives, Alex, we only really see Wi-Fi or even hard fixed wired Ethernet cable type of approaches for networking at an IT level and an OT level. Operational technology, we see all kinds of different networking at that level. So will Wi-Fi and 5G and 6G to come allow for a convergence of not just the IT network and the telecoms network, but also the control system network? Mm. When we see that control system network convergence, then basically we will have that industrial Internet of Things network that allows us to have anything plugging into the network and also communicating through the network in one way, shape or form, which I think will have quite a revolutionary impact on the way that control systems are done in the future.
Yes. Am I right in thinking as well that one of the big advances in 5G is not necessarily the speed at which it communicates, but also the width of the packets that it can communicate at one time, which is why it's much more applicable to business uses, because it's larger amounts of data at any single increment of time.
Yeah, and that's kind of under band of latency or bandwidth, you know. But so latency is the time it takes for information to change, and the bandwidth is the amount. And both on 5G, they're orders of magnitude higher than on 4G. But one of the big things is the number of connections you can have in a 5G network. That runs into, orders of magnitude more connections allowed in a 5G network compared with a 4G network. And that's why it's that type of platform for the Internet of Things, because if you're going to have hundreds of thousands of things connected to your 5G network, you can't do that with a 4G network, and you've got limitations on Wi-Fi as well. There's only so many nodes you can have on a Wi-Fi network. So, yeah, there's lots of things that 5G and Wi-Fi working together can achieve. Then you've got the public area. You know, we're used to the public. Maybe there's going to be Wi-Fi available in public, in the same way as we have 4G on our phones. Mm. There'll be more public hotspots. And then home networking. I think with COVID, one of the reasons it's difficult is that we've got far more demands on our networking at home with our Wi-Fi. And you see now that some companies are also offering 4G, 5G routers to give a level of resilience to your internet connection. So you've got your telco, your hardwired system, and you've got your wireless system. And if one goes down, you can revert onto the wireless application. Yes. So we'll probably see more resilience there as well.
Yes, we actually have. I moved into a new apartment a few months ago, and we are solely on a UK 5G router. So we don't even have the wired connection.
And some of the hurdles, let's have a quick look at some of the hurdles and then we'll wrap up. So business value, obviously businesses have invested heavily in Wi-Fi maybe, mm-hmm. or even LAN hardware. Why would they go beyond that and also bring cellular networks into their architecture? So business value has to be key to this, and there's still a level of skepticism around the business value when they've already invested in Wi-Fi of adopting 5G. There are some benefits, but we won't go into that. Maybe we'll do a deep dive into that later. Adoption, as I said, still there are some adoption hurdles that are going to be required to get over. And some of those are also about technology. If we think about the infrastructure and services put in place for 4G are predominantly around servicing the public, not necessarily industry. So some of the projects we've worked on, that's been a key takeaway, that you can't apply the same technology and software that controls a whole country's telco infrastructure to a single factory. It's complete overkill. So there needs to be some kind of rationalization of that technology and making it far easier for those things to do. And then you've got the politics around it. So you see a lot of that skepticism and some of the stories that come out about what the impact of 5G on the population.
Yes, there's some interesting theories. Perhaps some might call them conspiracy theories. I don't know. But yeah, there's certainly some niche narratives that aren't so niche actually. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's about pushing mass scale surveillance and maybe something like that. So anyway, so still some hurdles to come over there, but we'll see how that develops in the future. But very interesting how these two worlds that have lived apart for 150 years are now coming together.
Yeah, for sure. And it is, as you say, it's something we'll keep coming back to because it just grows and develops as time goes on and becomes more relevant. I think even our next interview, which we'll hype at the end of the chat, is also going to probably touch on things like this as well.
It's good to be back, Alex.
It is. Let's jump into our interview with Richard Foggy now. And then we'll be back for a wrap-up in a minute. So we are joined today for the Atlas podcast by Richard Foggy, currently Knowledge Transfer Manager at the Knowledge Transfer Network. Good afternoon, Richard. How are you doing?
Hello there.
I'm
delighted to be here.
Fantastic. If you'd like to give us a little bit of your background, how you got to where you are, we can get it going.
Surely. Oh, I was a victim of a concatenation of it. So I sort of had a science background, chemistry and biochemistry. Weren't really enough numbers in that. So I went on to do a bit of physics and was back when I had a real job. Was a device physicist at the GEC Hurst Research Centre, but that was a long time ago. I then found myself in Whitehall and did 24 years there, ending up as sort of the lead on electronics innovation. This was round about the turn of the millennium. So in addition to looking at sort of new semiconductor physics and things like that, was involved in some of the European technology platforms, looking at that. This web thing had sort of kicked into life about 1995, and the prefix E started appearing in front of e-health, and as they were sort of connecting toasters to the internet, refrigerators to the internet, I actually went over to Sweden to see Ericsson's internet fridge back in the day. Did that for a while, had a hand in setting up the technology strategy board that became Innovate UK, worked a lot with the 57 Ahinds of KTNs, knowledge transfer networks we had back in the day. Kind of took early retirement from that, and then found myself recruited by the Electronics Sensors and Photonics, ESP, KTN. There was then a merger of all the KTNs. And indeed, although I am a hardware geek, effectively. Because of the work I was doing, I was working more with medicos and architects and transport managers, and so was shifted over into digital and creative, both kinds of innovation team at KTN, where effectively I'm the IoT guy. And as we got part of the consortium to deliver UK 5G innovation network for DCMS, I've kind of morphed into the 5G guy too.
Yeah, we're gonna have to unpack a bit of that for now, Foggy, because we've got a lot. We travelled a long way from, mm-hmm. I think, from chemistry, biochemistry to
absolutely
electronics. Yeah. And
it's all science. It's fair to say. So
what's it? Just
science. You can do tech.
So. There you go. I was sat with my niece the other day. You probably won't listen to this, but anyway. And she was like, "Ah, science is boring." And I just sat there going, it's everything around you, you know, everything we can see, hear, touch, and stuff that we can't see. That's science.
Absolutely.
You know, so how can you say science is boring?
Oh, no. Indeed, the way they teach it, pedagogy, is a bit rubbish. It's almost sort of like cocktail party stuff to start off with. And sort of at GCSE or whatever they call them these days, you get a collection of disparate facts that you learn. And then when you go on to do A-levels or higher, they say, all that stuff we told you back then isn't strictly true. And they give you another whole load of disparate facts, whatever. If you then go on to sort of higher education, further education, they say, all that stuff isn't strictly true. And after a while, you figure out, and hang on, all this science stuff isn't strictly true. It's just a series of models that we use to, get a grasp of what we see and observe.
It's our best interpretation of the world, isn't it? That's all it really is. It's like
exactly. Yeah.
It's once we learn that we can't sense everything. That's what I thought was fascinating. Then we thought, what we need to do is build some stuff, some instrumentation that's going to observe stuff that we can't observe. And then we just got to believe that that's correct or whatever, not basically in a faith base, but, in a scientific process point of view.
Absolutely. Yeah. Maxwell got very close with understanding the true nature of colour. Unfortunately, he died young. James Clerk Maxwell, one of my sort of science heroes. Even today, the stuff in here we'll see in the infrared and the ultraviolet. So you can put apps on it that will give you pulse indication merely by looking at the infra-reddening of blood flow in the face and things like that. Yeah, we can't see it, but it's there.
Yeah,
but, the technology can see it for us.
Absolutely. And we'll touch a bit on the 5G world, because there's another invisible thing that happens around us all the time, not just 5G, yes. But... yeah, radio waves appearing everywhere, or appearing, are everywhere. Just a little bit about the kind of your electronics background then. Okay, you talked about physics, and you talked about doing some, it sounded like some, what was the background in your electronics then? What was it?
Compound semiconductors. So back in the mid-80s, I was working on... gallium arsenide, the indium phosphide, gallium indium arsenide phosphides.
Silicon doping. Is this what we mean? What
you're talking about? It was doping of the 3-5 stuff. So, gallium arsenide and indium phosphide were used for visible wavelength lasers.
Right.
So, I was developing it's sort of a single pass optical amplifier with about a 30 dB gain. It's the size of a grain of salt. And then some fool went and invented the self-propagating optical fiber. So the need for that sort of repeater technology. But of course, the solid state laser is now, was ubiquitous in CDs. and to this day it exists in optical drives.
Yeah.
So yeah, basically I was fabricating prototypical devices, either buying in the substrate and then doing the epi layers on top of that. So MOCVD, molecular beam epitaxy, if you want it really fine. And, what I can't do with an RF planar magnetron sputterer can't be done.
That's a sentence you don't often hear, yeah. Is it? That's
no, but how things have moved on. I mean, back then, indeed, device physics, it was more like device alchemy. We were wondering about the micron barrier. There was no such thing. And indeed, that was the limitations of basically the photolithography that we used at the time. And these days, they're turning out stuff at, you know, 5 nanometers. It's and we'll go to lower geometries. And indeed, for years they're saying, oh, no, you can't get lower than 120 nanometers. Oh, hang on, we can actually get to 65 nanometers. Now we're below 10 nanometers. And perhaps we are approaching the limits of those small geometries, but now we're looking at sort of 3D structures. So there's still a lot of science in that semiconductor physics.
So you've still got a big passion for it by the sounds of it there.
Absolutely. I mean, it is... It's indeed, you know, see the adverts for the latest sort of S22, 4 nanometers, 4 nm. And I sit there and I think, I wonder how many people know that that means 4 nanometers, know that it relates to the width of the individual transistors on the chips, have any idea how small 4 nanometers is. It is a marvel of engineering by any standard.
Yeah. Excellent. Sorry, Alex, you were going to say something there. I think I crossed
you. No, I was going to say a very bad joke and go, there's always room to grow, but it's actually quite the opposite, isn't it?
I was trying to think of this fact, and I think it might have come up on a previous podcast, but it was like a transistor these days is made up of something like, and I might get it wrong, something 12 or 16 atoms or something like that.
Yeah. We're getting there. Yeah, I suppose in the limit, you're looking at atomic monolayers.
Yeah.
And there's a whole host of sort of sound engineering reasons why you can't do that. And I'm sure we'll end up doing it in the fullness of time.
Brilliant stuff. We've definitely gone deep nerdy in this world.
Absolutely.
Let's go a little bit back. We'll be down to Planck's constant soon. But anyway, just a little bit about the up to date, really, and how we first met each other a little bit. I think the 5GEM project that we were working on and the creation of the UK 5G and things like this. How did you get involved with that? And obviously that was part of your relationship with KTN and things like that. But yeah, how was that for you, the beginning of UK 5G?
Indeed, it was interesting. So sort of DCMS started out with sort of some prototypical stuff, setting up some cores in three universities, so King's, Surrey and Bristol. Basically getting a head start on this 5G technology. The UK, notwithstanding, we invented the telephone. No, we didn't, but we clearly have a sort of a long and proud history in telecommunications up until we started falling behind. In 4G, we were somewhere 50th, 55th in terms of sort of national adoption. And DCMS decided that this wasn't going to be the case with 5G, and we were going to be one of the global trendsetters out in the van. And behold, it has come to pass. So about 5 years ago, they sort of started exploring, putting in cores. They then ran the urban connected communities, rural connected communities, and they wanted some sort of umbrella glue to hold those cohorts together, disseminate findings and learnings out into the sectors that are going to use, are using, and will more and more in the future be adopting 5G based solutions. So we formed a little consortium with old friends of ours, Cambridge Wireless, who are based in Cambridge, notwithstanding 74% of their membership is out with London and the South East. All the big players are in there, as well as SMEs and the mid-caps. And as you would expect from the name, they know a thing or two about wireless. KTN covers all sectors. So our day job is helping innovators from whatever sector navigate the innovation support ecosystem. We're basically there to help them on their journeys. So we have good reach into those sectors. So it was kind of a marriage made in heaven. They can cover the pointy head, the technical stuff. And then when you need to engage with the sectors to show them the benefits of, get them engaged in the discussion, then KKTN is equipped to do that. We also run a number of innovation networks around immersive, cybersecurity, construction, what have you got? So that's how we got the UK 5G Innovation Network gig. And UK 5G, truth be told, is one of the projects within the wider 5G testbeds and trials cohort. But our role is there to, act as a bit of glue. So we're the hub for dissemination and run a number of working groups to assist DCMS address those barriers that can be tackled with policy interventions and all those sorts of activities.
Yeah, and the glue is an important thing, I think, as well, where people just, it's just the glue, but actually that's what brings everybody together. And I think that's the one thing, the UK 5G have really done a good job of bringing all of these cats running in different direction and bringing them together and feeling like it's a sense of unity around what all those projects are doing. And like you said, some of them are in the creative arts, some of them are in manufacturing, some are in logistics. There's a whole different set of verticals there that we're working in. Maybe not a killer question, but what's 5G to you and how does it differ to what you've worked with before?
Oh, okay. That's a bloody good question. As any fool know, 5G is 25% bigger than 4G. No, not a bit of it. It's essentially the convergence of telecoms and ICT, if you will. Telecoms is a much earlier technology, argued. Conceivably about the same time, I suppose, if you think of sort of Charles Babbage's differentiating engine and things like that, and wireless telegraphy.
I was going to go back to Marconi. I think you've gone further, don't you?
I'm old. I've been around an awful long time. It's fair to say. Indeed, that Archimedes bloke. But indeed, they've kind of had parallel sort of developments, if you will. And so there's been the sort of the IT discipline, if you will, from the early computers through to the sort of the dedicated server on premises. Oh, and then you've got the off, the client server relationship, and then you've got cloud based and all the rest of it. Telecoms similarly started out as fixed. We did have early mobile wireless back in the 1930s, 40s. Some of the American railroads were implementing early solutions in that space. Mobile stuff, 1G, 2G, 3G, 4G, they've all been iterations of that sort of cellular configuration and way of working. They speak their own language. They have bespoke hardware, both in terms of the radio equipment and the silicon that sort of sits behind it and powers it. 5G, however, is internet protocol based. It's all IP based. And aside from the funny radio front ends, everything behind that runs on COTS hardware. So x86 chips. The thinking behind that is there's a much lower implementation cost because we make loads more of generic CPU, also GPU chips, than we do the ASICs for the older 4G, 3G, blah, 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 etc. So total cost of ownership should be reduced. I sometimes quip that, yeah, 5G takes the C out of ICT, effectively. So, indeed, if you can code for an N86 platform, if you can use a dashboard on an off-the-shelf Dell machine or something like that, you can run a 5G network. Everything, as I say, aside from the radio, is virtualized, so it's just code. So it's a massive simplification from the user perspective. It's also the case that with 5G, you can architect the intelligence into the network. So we are successful at using 4G to move data somewhere to where the intelligence is added to it. It is then fed back to whoever needs it in terms of insights. Indeed, the information that they need for their business functions. With 5G, you can architect that intelligence to be done somewhere in the network. Ideas of multi-access edge computing, MEC. So it disrupts that sort of classical cloud model of doing things. So there's a lot of flexibility, a lot of versatility in it. Perhaps too much at this juncture. It can be frightfully confusing. It's not yet mature enough where you can say, ah, yeah, I want to do this, so I need that bunch of radio hardware, I need this software platform, and I want that MEC implementation to do that. We're still feeling our way with that, but it is a radically different from what's gone before.
And I think that's a great summary of it, really, because you could easily go on to the different, you know, bandwidths and the throughput and everything like that. But really, the fundamentals of it is it's creating a brand new platform of hardware and software and all of those types of technology stuff to move forward upon. And that's why I think you see some people talk about 6G and everyone's going, oh, we haven't got 5G yet. But actually, there's so much fundamentals being put in place with this type of technology, isn't it?
Change in 5G, because it is so virtualized, that's where you get these awesome capabilities from. So, yeah, the reason that it has, you know, massive throughput potential is through carrier aggregation. Now, once upon a time, that would have been a hardware job that no one would do because you'd have to go out and string up, you know, cables. It's now, and okay, there's going to be 5G engineers gnashing their teeth. A few keystrokes, and you can double your bandwidth, subject to the resources being available and all the rest of it. And indeed, there's a lot of potential there because you don't have to do those keystrokes. You can put a rules engine in place that dynamically adjusts the configuration of your network to meet the demands that you are placing on it in a dynamic way. So, yeah, there's a lot of opportunity, particularly for optimization around the environmental performance of 5G networks. You don't have to keep the whole thing lit up all the time on the off chance that a subscriber is going to want to make a call in the middle of nowhere at 3 o'clock in the morning or something like this. It has the flexibility, the dynamic capabilities and the reaction time to scale itself to suit the task at hand.
Yeah. And that's the thing with when we, you know, the fundamental understanding of these technologies is like, and you've got to know the history behind it, haven't you? Like the wired networks, the web with your telephones and the telephone exchanges and how they operated. It's all come from that lineage, hasn't it? It has indeed.
It's useful if somebody knows. Yeah, we've all seen those sort of dystopian sci-fi movies where the knowledge that built the systems that society depends on has been lost. They start to fail, and what do you do? But again, from a user, a customer perspective, no, 5G is easier to use, and it is 10-100 times quicker, more capacity, and the low latency. Resilience. When we get into private networks, you can build in security that you just don't get sort of with Wi-Fi systems and the like. So, yeah, it's got a lot of advantages over what's gone before and some drawbacks too, it's fair to say. So, yeah, when you get to the higher frequencies, shorter wavelengths, it won't go into buildings. You can stop it with a piece of paper, you know. Good news, a tinfoil hat will block 5G. The next article says, so there's an issue of how do you get it into premises and things like that. But we're seeing, yeah, pragmatic solutions where the outdoor 5G signal is being passed off to sort of Wi-Fi 6. Or something internally. These hybrids. Don't get me wrong, you know, your Wi-Fi is perfectly adequate for many applications and it is certainly going to coexist with 5G for a long time to come.
Yeah, and that's why we won't be seeing Wi-Fi removed from our phones anytime soon. That's kind of the point that we see that unification happen today, but it's likely to happen more in the network in the future as well.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, really great stuff. I like the take on it because I think there's many other stories out there about 5G and what it is and what it isn't, or what it is and what it isn't. But that's a really good good explanation. So what's next? What's on the foggy horizon in the future?
Okay, yeah. So, indeed, kudos to DCMS for taking a hefty punt on this. So they've sunk about 250 million. When you gear in the industry investment, that tots up to $500 million has gone into these 5G testbeds and trials. over the past 4 years. It's demonstrated, one, that it works. Two, it's proven some business cases. Yes, we can see where there are ROIs. We're starting to see adoption across sectors, some faster than others, for a whole host of reasons. So where are we going for? We're going to go a little bit deeper into the sectors to try and encourage adoption there. Transport and logistics, good sector. Ports, way out there in the implementation. The environment of a port is such that suits itself to 5G. They have clear ROIs. It also helps them meet safety considerations. So it's becoming a done deal there. Other transport in urban environments where we're starting to see public network coverage is pretty good in urban centres, less so as you get outside, it was ever thus.
Oh, apart from in Dorset, because they've got a great fire.
Well, it did. Oh, yeah.
The guys in the Dorset, they're leading the fight for this, aren't they?
Absolutely, indeed. We had the showcase. Where was it? 22nd, 23rd March. Up in Birmingham, and the sort of the best collaborator prize did indeed go to Dave Happy from 5G Rural, and rightly so. They've experimented, implemented, proved a range of use cases from agri, marine ecology, straight up rural connectivity. We will see those other sectors following along. The creative industries, of course, well, they're creative. We've got cameras these days that output, 12, 15K, Lord sakes, that's... That's better than bird vision. So they need the bandwidth. And indeed, the potential that's been demonstrated for real-time music and art performance from disparate remote locations, that's going to be transformative. Indeed, during the lockdown, I'm a bit of a museum myself, strumming guitar. And during the lockdown, bored with no one to play with, I bought myself a looper, which is kind of part of the solution. But with 5G, you just switch it on. So the drummers in Birmingham and the bass players in Dorset, and it makes no difference. The low latency is such, it's like being in the same room together. So, very, very transformative in those sectors. CivTech, yes, you can use 5G for social care, health. Liverpool, fine example. Way out there. Real services being sent to real people, making real improvements to their lives. You're never going to get a business case predicated on that one use, though. But of course, once you've put it in, when you add in education, other local government functions and other civil services to be believed, then it stacks up. Absolutely. So
the possibilities are endless.
Indeed. Manufacturing, indeed. The advantage of 5G is that a tinfoil hat will stop it. So in a manufacturing context, you're basically an operation inside a big tin box or tin boxes. So, you can put 5G in there. Again, it gives you flexibility over movement of your assets there. So, yeah, indeed. Mm. Come on down to UK 5G, and there's a timeline for the various sectors.
Yes, probably we will. Yeah, we'll pop links up to everything on the on the episode description, so everyone can follow through and see all of these exciting things. I'm just looking at the time. As always, we have managed to talk way over, but that's fantastic, and it means we're probably talking about something interesting. I will.
Okay. Anything in particular you wanted me to cover that we've not?
Oh, if there's anything further we want you to cover, we will invite you back on.
Okay, guys, you know where I live. Do not be strangers.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us. Talking. And we'll speak to you next time.
Brilliant. Okay. Be safe. Bye. Alex, Martin, take care.
So, first episode of the second series. Thank you for joining me, Martin.
I like the fact that we're going to call this second series. How long will the second series go on for, Alex? We don't know, because we never knew when the first series was going to end, did we?
We let it run. And
It run until we ran out of steam. We're back.
Yes, we're back by popular demand, I'm sure.
Well, we enjoy it. So if that's popular demand, that's good enough for me.
100%. And yes, we will be back in 2 weeks' time. With another fascinating interview, more news, more tech, things like that. For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ats_Atlas and on LinkedIn at ats-Atlas.